Thank you for listening to the Gospel Coalition interview series. I'm Colin Hansen, editorial director for TGC. I remember the excitement when I learned I could study with Scott Manich in a PhD seminar on pastoral theology in the Reformation era. The professor of church history and the history of Christian thought at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, north of Chicago, has invested years studying in careful detail the church records of Reformation Geneva. But we also planned in that course to study the work of Johannes Oecolampadius in Basel, Richard Baxter's still influential book, The Reformed Pastor, William Perkins on the art of prophesying, and of course, the writing and practice of Martin Luther himself. This is why you enroll in seminary. But not everyone I found was so excited for me. One advisor responded to my enthusiasm and said, "What do you think you can learn for today from the Reformation? You'd be better off studying modern techniques for church planting and growth." To this teacher, at least, the Reformation era is so distant in space and time from our own that we're wasting our breath discussing what lessons we can learn for pastoral ministry today by reading about Calvin and his 16th and early 17th century company of pastors. I'm grateful that Manich disagrees with this teacher and has written a groundbreaking new book in the Oxford Studies in Historical Theology series called Calvin's Company of Pastors, Pastoral Care in the Emerging Reformed Church, 1536 to 1609. He joins me today to tease out some of the contemporary implications of his work. Thank you, Scott, for joining me in this interview.
Well, thank you, Colin. Great to be here.
Well, let's talk, first of all, what initially drew you to study this subject? Had scholarship already produced a detailed understanding of the pastoral practices of Reformed Geneva?
No, they really hadn't. Generally, Calvin is treated as a theological mind. In recent years, there has been some attention paid to his sermons and to his concern with church discipline. But too often, Calvin the thinker has been disjoined from Calvin the pastor, who was vitally engaged in day-to-day ministry. And so the caricature is perpetuated that Calvin was someone who delivered sermons but really wasn't vitally involved and engaged in daily pastoral work among his flock or engaging with colleagues. So it was a topic that really invited further research. I came to it over a decade ago as I was working through the sermons of Theodore Beza, and I was struck time and time again just how rich and pastoral and even practical they were as they addressed the pastoral office and called men to a higher standard in terms of their ministries. So it was really as I worked through Theodore Beza's sermons that I began to envision a project that would allow me not only to consider the theory of pastoral work, but the actual practice of it.
For all of the criticism that Calvin takes as being some type of tyrant in Geneva, being some sort of horrible place to live, at least by modern or secular standards, is it surprising then that more people haven't actually investigated what that ministry looked like in Geneva of the Reformation era?
Well, I do think that the response of the professor that you mentioned in the introduction is pretty typical. And it's not only true of perceptions of Calvin. I think there's a widespread view in the church today that ultimately we really don't have a lot to learn from people of the past. Sometimes it can be a kind of adolescent snobbery. Sometimes it's simply lack of exposure to the rich pastoral themes in the literature of the Reformation and the remarkable degree to which the 16th century reformers were really experimenting, even as they're studying the biblical text and trying to construct a more biblical vision for the pastoral office. They're also experimenting. They're trying things. They're exploring how the pastoral office can and should work in specific contexts, very different contexts when you look at the Anabaptist communities or the Lutheran churches or Calvin's Geneva. So there's a world there that's largely unknown, sometimes by just ignorance, sometimes perhaps by a certain kind of arrogance, a contemporary view that a kind of presentism that we are where we are, and we're superior to everyone in the past. But I do think, and as I've spent time in the sources and as I spent time working on this project, I was reminded again and again both how foreign Geneva was, but also how contemporary it was as pastors did their day-to-day work.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about some of those specifics. I want to start here. What would be the top modern misconception you come across regularly about that pastoral care of Calvin and his company of pastors as you try to bridge the dissimilarity and the similarity between these two eras?
Yeah, I think probably one of the major misconceptions is that Calvin and perhaps the Reformed clergy in general promoted a kind of pastoral work that was almost exclusively pulpit-centered. Pastors are talking heads who deliver finely crafted sermons to their congregants. Now, certainly, the ministry of the word from the pulpit is extraordinarily important for Calvin and for the Reformed tradition in general. There's no questioning that. But the ministry of the word is more than preaching. It involves pastoral visitation. It involves church discipline. It involves catechesis. It involves preparation for the sacraments. It involves godly conversation. It involves comforting the dying. It involves teaching people to pray. All of those, from Calvin's perspective and from a Reformed perspective, belong to the ministry of the word. So to the extent that we think of Geneva's pastors or the pastors, Reformed pastors in the 16th and 17th century as simply being word machines delivering sermons, we've really misunderstood how they understood the role of the ministry of the word.
What would a day in the life of Calvin or Beza look like?
Well, these men were remarkably productive and sometimes to a shocking extent. In Calvin's Geneva, Calvin was not the only pastor in Geneva. Within the city walls, there were three parish churches, so there was a team of around 6 to 8 men who worked alongside Calvin in their daily ministries. And within the city walls, within those three parish churches, during the course of the week, around 33 sermons were delivered. So certainly one of the things the ministers did was they preached, and they preached a lot. For Calvin, he would regularly preach 18 to 22 sermons a month. So preaching was certainly a prominent part of their ministry, and preparing for those sermons was prominent.
And without notes, right?
Well, we know for sure that Calvin preached extemporaneously. We can't be entirely certain whether the other ministers did.
Okay.
The evidence, I think, points to the fact that Beza probably also preached extemporaneously, but I really can't state with authority that the other pastors did such.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to preaching, the company of pastors met every Friday for what we might call a preaching clinic. Calvin called it his congregation. He didn't invent this idea. The idea actually was invented by Ulrich Zwingli in Zurich. But the idea was that the pastors would come together on a weekly basis to conduct a kind of public Bible study where the biblical text would be studied in the original language, and one of the pastors would be responsible for both exegeting the text and then delivering either a sermon or a kind of extensive commentary on the biblical text, followed by discussion, criticism, encouragement. So part of the pastor's responsibility was to attend and participate in these weekly congregation services that took place on Fridays. Another activity was the consistory meetings that met at noon every Thursday. And sometimes these consistory meetings would last for upwards of 2 or even 3 hours per week. At the consistory meetings, the pastors, which usually included not only the pastors from the immediate city, but from the surrounding countryside, so perhaps 16 to 20 pastors, plus the 12 lay elders would meet together for the purpose of dealing with sin within the churches that they served. And so a variety of people suspected of various kinds of moral failures, whether it was drunkenness or spousal abuse, whether it was angry words in the marketplace, or something even more bizarre, such as worshiping the sun, as in one instance, a man was brought to the consistory who was found worshiping the sun in the marketplace. But whatever the moral concern, these people would be brought to the consistory, and behind closed doors, the pastors and elders together would both question the offender and then provide some form of spiritual medicine, as they put it, whether it was a reproof, some kind of spiritual advice, or in the worst-case scenario, a suspension, temporary suspension from the Lord's Supper, or a permanent excommunication. So church discipline was another prominent feature of pastoral life. In addition to that, the pastors were responsible to oversee catechesis, which occurred on Sundays at noon. Pastors would preach a catechetical sermon, and many times then would also visit families in their homes to make sure that the children were being properly catechized. There was a formal annual household visitation in Geneva that occurred shortly before Easter each year, and elders and pastors together attempted to visit every household in the city at least once a year to make sure that the household was well run, the parents were providing spiritual oversight and instruction to their families, and also to make sure that there was peace and harmony in the home. So we have then church discipline, we have visitation, we have catechesis, we have preaching, and then another important aspect of the pastor's work was to visit the sick. In Calvin's Geneva, there was a law that stated that a person who had been sick for more than 3 days was required to summon the pastor. And the reason was that people that were sick were believed to need spiritual consolation, and those who were dying needed to be both comforted but also reminded of the gospel, both the hope of the gospel but also the imperative for repentance and faith in Christ at the end of one's life. So the importance of visitation, providing care for the sick, and I should mention as well, and I'll say this finally, visiting people in prison. There was a number of pastors would be designated each week to go to the city prison to preach a sermon and to provide spiritual advice, comfort, consolation, rebuke if need be, to the prisoners that were being held in the city. So this was a very intensive life-on-life, person-to-person kind of ministry. This was not a ministry of simply delivering sermons. It involved engaging people in the nitty-gritty of life and encountering them where they were in the marketplace, in their homes, on the city streets.
And he somehow also found time to write the Institutes and update it.
That's right. And that was something else that was surprising to me, that actually many of the pastors had very active writing careers. Of the 135 pastors that I track through the course of my book over a period of around 75 years, around 20% of them wrote books. Many of them were theological books or exegetical books, commentaries. Other pastors wrote poetry or historical works or polemical works. So the pastors were very busy people and very much engaged in the work of ministry, both from pulpit and among their congregations.
What would you say is the one pastoral challenge that frustrated Calvin more than any other?
Oh, that's a great question, Colin. I think certainly one of the greatest challenges that Calvin encountered, he was fully aware of the depraved nature of human beings. He was no perfectionist, and he recognized that even men and women saved by God's grace, transformed through the gospel, will still struggle in sin. He didn't doubt that. He knew that to be a fact. And yet, Calvin, in his day-to-day ministry, and particularly in the work of the consistory, really engaged people at their worst. When you read, even to this day, when you read through the literally thousands of pages of consistory minutes from the 16th and early 17th century, one is overwhelmed. And I think Calvin was sometimes overwhelmed by how far people who professed Christ came from living in a Christ-like manner. So the distance between, on the one hand, the ideal that we're called to as God's people, living sanctified lives in gratitude to God, on the one hand, and the very real struggles that people face, both with their own flesh, but also in broken relationships, was so very prominent. So that discrepancy between the ideal and the reality, I think, frustrated Calvin a lot.
Well, and isn't that why we study from him? We study him and we study his era, because that sounds like almost every pastor I talk to today.
You know what? I think so. Sometimes we have an idealized view of what the church was like in the past, and we have our heroes, and we paint perhaps the era of the Reformation or the era of the early church as if it was a time of unguarded bliss, and the heroes of the faith lived heroically. But in my study of Calvin's Geneva, I was deeply impressed by not only the degree of sin and brokenness within the congregants, within the people's lives to whom Calvin ministered, but I was truly moved by the courage and the strength and the perseverance displayed by the pastors who, week in and week out, handled not simply one or two cases of church discipline, but on a regular basis would handle 15 or 20 cases of church discipline each week, and then trying to maintain contact with those who had been disciplined, maintain contact to encourage them to repent, to encourage them to find spiritual growth in the midst of difficult life situations. So in that sense, I think you're right. Pastors today who become disheartened and discouraged by just how many of the saints within their congregations aren't living in a saintly way, Calvin experienced that as well.
Well, let's talk about one of those examples, and this stood out. You correct me on any of the details here, but I was fascinated to learn how the company of pastors handled caring for Genevans infected by the plague. Correct me if I'm wrong about this story, but wasn't there an example of a family disciplined because they abandoned the daughter of the family who was pregnant and she had the plague, and they all locked her inside and stood outside the house to try to not be infected while she screamed in agony and died?
Yeah, that's right. That's probably the most poignant story that I came across in my study of the consistory minutes. But there are many others like that. I'll say a little more about that specific incident in a moment. But one thing that really comes through clearly in the consistory minutes, that the consistory is not simply a kind of agency of social control that's trying to force people to live in a more godly manner. The consistory, and in fact church discipline in Geneva, was truly a form of pastoral care. Now, to be sure, it could be heavy-handed, but it was a form of pastoral care where pastors were engaging people in the most difficult, the most painful situations in their lives. The pastors speak up for those who are on society's margins. They protect children from abusive parents. They protect spouses who are being beaten up by drunkard husbands. They are caring for the sick. They're seeking to bring healing to broken relationships. So one of the primary concerns of Calvin and discipline in Geneva is to provide pastoral care and to protect vulnerable people. And that was borne out in the illustration that you just mentioned, Colin. In that particular case, it comes from one of the village churches that surrounds Geneva, a little village called Malval. And in that case, the plague had come into the region, and as sometimes happened when people became infected by the plague, family members would flee so as to avoid being infected themselves. And in this particular case, a young woman who was pregnant, very last days of her pregnancy, came down with the plague, and she was abandoned by her family. And she ends up dying in agony, crying out for help. No neighbors, and in fact, her mother and sister and brother are unwilling to help in any tangible way. They're close at hand, clearly, because they have dug a grave for both their wow. their sister or daughter and also her child. In that case, the consistory calls the mother and the siblings to the consistory chambers and really reads them the Riot Act about their inhumanity in refusing to care for a family member. But what's interesting then is they didn't stop with that. The consistory then sent a letter to the city council saying, informing them of the situation and demanding that the city council provide some kind of mechanism in the future to protect people that are infected by plague from being abandoned by their neighbors, their friends, and their family. Mm. So the consistory becomes, in a sense, a kind of conscience within the city for those who are misused and abused, and many times the consistory is appealing to the city magistrates to intervene on behalf of a more just treatment of those who are on the margins, those who are on those who are vulnerable, those who are weak.
Well, it is a remarkable story, and there were other remarkable stories. I want to get to one about a couple pastors you mentioned in there. But first, to clarify, Calvin and Beza were themselves exempted from visiting people sick with the plague. Is that right?
Well, the story's a little more complex than that.
Okay.
In the 1540s, the company of pastors, so Calvin, along with his ministerial colleagues in Geneva, are attempting to create a kind of policy on how to treat plague victims. And if you think about it, the matter is pretty complex mm-hmm. because you can either assign pastoral duties to a single individual, and thus you infect one pastor or run the risk of infecting one pastor, or if you create a kind of pastoral cycle so that different pastors on different days are visiting the plague hospital to care for plague victims, then you're inadvertently jeopardizing your whole pastoral company. And the way it worked out was in the early years, in the 1540s and early 1550s, the policy was established that that the company of pastors would draw by lot one pastor who would be responsible to go outside the city walls to provide care in the plague hospital, which was located outside the city walls a couple of hundred yards from the city. And the debate actually in the 1540s was whether or not Calvin's name should be included by lot. So should Calvin potentially be selected? And at this point, the city council intervened and said, by no means. Calvin is too precious to the church to be listed among pastors who could be charged with the responsibility of caring for plague victims.
And Beza wanted to be included, right?
He did want to be included, but the city magistrates refused to allow him to be included in that in that lottery. Now, after Calvin's death, the situation changes, and this was largely, I would say, to Beza's credit. The lottery system is done away with, but also the notion that the senior pastor or the moderator of the city church would be exempt from visiting plague victims was also excluded. So after Calvin's death in the 1560s, 1570s, 1580s, we find that all of the pastors then have responsibility for plague visitation, not just a single individual chosen by lottery. And Beza himself then, as it were, becomes responsible for that task as well.
Well, a couple incidents I want to mention. You can clear up any details here. There was, when they were debating this, when they went through the lottery once, there was a pastor whose name was drawn. He was sent out for this visitation duty, got the plague, died. there was another person who volunteered to do it. Another pastor volunteered to do it, went to do the visitation, contracted the plague, and died. Correct?
That's right.
Okay.
And I, if I could just say a little bit about that, it's a reminder that a lot of these pastors are living pretty heroic lives.
Yeah.
Now, not all of them. And my book points out plenty of cases of pastoral cowardice. But I was truly impressed both in that instance, but also as I studied the life of a pastor in the countryside surrounding the city walls of Geneva, just how difficult that life was and how much courage was required. By the end of the century, one of the challenges that countryside pastors faced was not simply the plague, but also the re-Catholicization of the surrounding region. And one of the consequences of that was that several of the pastors were actually kidnapped by Catholic troops and were held for ransom for several months at a time. A number of the pastors actually, when they went to church on Sunday morning, had to be accompanied by guards to protect them from attacks by the Savoyard soldiers. So being a pastor in Calvin's Geneva was not all light and fun. It required a lot of courage, a lot of moral courage. It required a lot of spiritual courage.
Yeah. Well, what? Let's talk a little bit about that transition between Calvin and Beza as leader of this company of pastors. What was the biggest change that took place in that transition?
Well, that's a great question, and it's a complex one. Calvin dies in 1564, and Theodore Beza is very much the heir apparent to Calvin as the moderator of the Company of Pastors. Now, I need to hasten to say that both during Calvin's lifetime and also during Beza's lifetime, the Company of Pastors was a company. It was not an autocratic organization run by one. Calvin was never the dictator of the pastoral company in Geneva. He was not the dictator of the city of Geneva either, nor was Beza. The company worked in tandem. They worked as a group. They made decisions as a group in their weekly meetings. So that did not change in terms of the model of leadership. There are various, we might at this point view them as somewhat minor changes over the course of the decades following Calvin's death. During the half century after Calvin's death, the city magistrates really put a full court press on trying to retain prerogatives that it had ceded to Calvin in the early years of the Reformation. For example, one of the most prominent of these was the right to intrude, the right for the magistrates to intrude itself into cases of church discipline. Calvin had worked so hard, Calvin and the pastors of Geneva had worked so hard up to 1555 to make sure that the city magistrates could not circumvent church discipline. And that was that that victory, we might say, that Calvin had lasted for about 50 years. But by the early 17th century, we find the city magistrates beginning to intervene in church discipline cases, in some cases circumventing the decisions of the consistory. We also find by the early 17th century that the city magistrates are increasingly intervening in decisions relating to pastoral appointment and pastoral deployment, as well as what we would call today ordination. So one of the broad trends we see in Geneva's religious history during the 16th and early 17th centuries is the civil authorities gaining more authority over the life of the church than it had had, say, in the 1550s or when Calvin dies in the 1560s. That was probably the most prominent change.
I think it would surprise a lot of people to know just how much tension there was when they're used to seeing Calvin as some sort of theocratic dictator. the amount of tension there was between the civil magistrates and the company of pastors. Pretty significant.
Oh, I think you're right, Colin. And in fact, that depiction of Calvin as the Pope of Geneva or the dictator of Geneva is really overplayed. Within the context of the 16th century, and this is somewhat ironic, what Calvin really was trying to avoid was the paradigm that was being played out in most other reformed cities in Western Europe, cities such as Strasbourg and Zurich and Bern and Basel. In those cities, you have a regnant, what's sometimes called Erastianism, where the civil authorities control the church. And so what Calvin's trying to do is not trying to control the state of Geneva. After all, Calvin was simply an employee. He could be fired on 48 hours' notice. He was an employee in Geneva, he and the other pastors. But what Calvin is trying to do is he's trying to protect the church in Geneva from being overwhelmed and being commandeered, we might say, by the state, as it had in the other reformed cities of Switzerland and Germany and France. So Calvin's concern is to protect the relative autonomy of the church rather than trying to foist the church onto the state and kind of seize control of the machinery of city government. Now, to be sure, Calvin commanded an enormous amount of moral authority within the city due to his theological acumen and his international prominence. But Calvin has no specific political authority or civil political authority within the city.
Yeah. Again, I think surprising to a lot of people. Well, I want to transition in the last couple minutes to talk about just kind of jump to our contemporary scene and try to see what some specific things that might speak into our time. You write near the end of the book this, speaking of the company of pastors, though this collegial model of ministry did not foster bold innovation nor allow for strong dissent, it did create a pastoral culture in Geneva where ministers depended on one another, learned from one another, were subject to one another, and forgave one another. Contemporary Protestantism, with its infatuation for robust individualism, celebrity preachers, and ministry empires, has much to learn from the example of Geneva's church. That got me thinking about whether Calvin would recognize anything about our church life and cultural situation today, at least in the United States. We want to reach back and claim him for some of this wisdom, but I'm wondering, would he claim us, or what might he begin to say to us in our pastoral culture today?
Yeah, I think what Calvin would encourage us to do today is to recover a vision for collegial ministry where pastors are recognized as possessing the same calling, occupying the same office, and thus being responsible one to another, responsible for correction, for encouragement, holding one another accountable. And providing what we might call continuing education. The situation in Geneva, Calvin really did encourage this notion of collegial ministry. It was a company of pastors that worked together. The men they got to know each other. They met together several times a week. They knew each other's names, obviously. They were involved in ministry together. They held one another accountable. And I think Calvin, although our contemporary context is very different, and day-to-day lives of many of our pastors is significantly different than what Calvin faced, I think Calvin's example encourages us to be creative in the way in which we create groups of pastors, companies of pastors, associations of pastors who know one another, who care for one another, who pray for one another, and also who hold one another accountable. So certainly the implementation of the specifics might well not be practical for today. But the overall concern, or what we might say Calvin's vision for a collegial pastoral ministry, I think is an encouragement and challenge for us today.
Did other pastors actually challenge Calvin?
There are several occasions when they did.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, and there are several occasions where the company of pastors, during its meetings, it was kind of a one-man, one-vote situation where on various questions they would collaborate, they would discuss, sometimes they would debate. But at the end of the day, after the vote, the company stood as a man, as it were, before the civil authorities and before the watching world. And there are a couple of instances where it seems that Calvin lost the vote, as it were, where Calvin's views didn't prevail within the company of pastors.
Well, and certainly communion every week. Was that by the other pastors, or that by the civil magistrates?
That was an intrusion on the part of the civil magistrate.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah.
But what would be an example of something where the other pastors voted Calvin down?
Yeah, it didn't happen a lot. And again, the company of pastors, much of what's taking place is taking place kind of behind the scenes. But in terms of decisions related to whether or not to appoint a young ministerial candidate to a rural office, there's an example of that, for example. So, you know, choosing candidates for office would be one way in which the collective work of the company of pastors was required, and no single person, as it were, would trump all of his other colleagues.
Yeah. Well, that's, very interesting. Again, lots of things that would dispel common notions, popular notions of Calvin. Well, I wanted to just close. I just wanted to read. This is a beautiful, you closed the book with this, and I thought it was so beautiful. A lot of people probably don't know a lot about Beza, but you're an expert in Beza, and I understand you've got some work on him going forward, but I wanted to read this from him. It comes from a sermon where he says, "O Lord, support us therefore by your infinite goodness. Preserve in us a good and right conscience. Fill us with zeal for your glory. Increase in us the knowledge, the wisdom, the love, and the endurance required for such a calling. In sum, be pleased to bless our modest efforts." Well, thank you, Scott, for writing the book, especially. I highly commend it. Hope people will pick it up. And again, thank you for spending time helping us to learn from this company of pastors and for doing all this detailed scholarship that seems so relevant to us today.
Well, thank you so much, Colin. It's been a pleasure being with you.